Coming to you from the AT&T podcast studio, this is Long Story Short. I'm Ted Struley, the executive director at Oklahoma Watch. We're a statewide nonprofit news organization that specializes in investigative reporting. You're listening to our weekly podcast, which lets you hear directly from our journalists as they provide deeper insight into their recently published stories. Jennifer Palmer covers education for Oklahoma Watch, and she's been reporting on the fallout from a criminal case against a teacher well known for his role in leading that teacher walkout in 2018. Jennifer, let's start with that teacher walkout. How instrumental was Alberto Morjon, then a teacher at Stillwater Junior High?
Yeah, he has really been credited with, setting the date for the walkout and kind of he started this Facebook group. This was back in the spring of 2018. There was some talk of a possible strike. Teachers were certainly starting to organize. And he had gone on Facebook looking for a group to join as part of that effort and didn't find one. So he started his own, and that group really mushroomed in a matter of days to like 75,000 members. And that group is what really where teachers gathered online to discuss when to walk out, how to do it, who was in, who was out. I mean, he started creating these lists of, districts that had decided to join and that kind of thing. So he was very, very instrumental at the walkout. You know, folks took pictures with him. I mean, very, very well known. He was interviewed by national media, that kind of thing.
And he continued to lead the Facebook group until sometime in 2020, right? What happened?
That's right. He kept the group going, posted about bills and legislation, some advocacy for public education. And then sometime in 2020, he kind of disappeared. His socials were deleted, and the group was passed over to a new administrator named Jamie Cole, a fifth grade teacher in Duncan at the time. And they renamed the group and kept it going, but he was no longer active.
Well, tell us what happened here. Alberto ended up going to prison, right? How did that come about?
That's right. What we found out then was that he had been arrested. One of his students had gone to the police, said he had been sending her inappropriate pictures and sexting her for 2 years. So he was arrested. He ended up taking a plea and going to prison.
And the victim here was a middle school student, right? He taught at Stillwater Junior High?
That's right. She met him in his class when she was 14. And that is when, he first contacted her on Instagram, and they started these, messages outside of the classroom, and that, started out somewhat innocently, but turned sexual pretty quickly. And those continued until she was 16 when she went to the police.
Now, in addition to that criminal case, there was also a civil case somewhere along the way. What'd you learn about that?
Right. The student did file a civil lawsuit, and some information about the criminal case, of course, came out in that. Her allegations were against the school district at Stillwater Public Schools. Said that they knew or should have known that he was a predator and kept her safe. There were some alarming signs that her attorneys pointed out in the lawsuit. Things like, he was a very popular teacher. Some other teachers joked that he had a harem in his classroom. Now, these were mostly girls, but not all girls. He also coached baseball. So, some of the baseball players would hang out in his room at lunch and, in different times. There were some other strange signs. Apparently students liked to bring him chocolate milk. They would leave the lunchroom, which was against school rules, just to bring him chocolate milk. Things like that, where, her attorney said they should have known that this was, perhaps predatory or alarming, that should have been taken more seriously. The school's defense was kind of, well, you know, we didn't know he was contacting a student privately. You know, these were things that, you know, maybe had been unusual, but certainly weren't too much of a red flag.
Well, and he was voted favorite teacher by the students, wasn't he? So it maybe didn't look completely ridiculous that there were students wanting to hang out with him and sort of be friendly with him. He was very popular.
He was.
Were you able to find out how much the school district settled for? Did you get any of the details?
No, I really haven't. The school district has kept that under wraps. You know, that this case settled late last year. The school board voted to basically, you know, take whatever the attorney decides. So there, you know, when I requested the public documents of the settlement, the school district says no one on the board or in the school district has a copy of that settlement. So, you know, we assume that the insurance company made the settlement, and that's why it hasn't become public yet.
There were certainly limits on that policy of some kind. Do we know what the limit was? And do we have any idea how that might track with similar cases?
Yeah, you know, my reporting shows it's probably $1 million or less. And that's according to an attorney who handles a lot of these cases, not this one in particular, but others with similar allegations. And there have been others recently. You know, we've had Kingfisher, Ringling, some of these others that have been in the news. Some of those were over $1 million, you know, 3.5, 4. But those also had multiple victims. And I think that's probably the major difference here is that in Alberto's case, there was just one student that that we know of.
Well, we mentioned too the criminal case that went along with this. What happened with that? Is he still in prison?
No, he was released last year after just about 2 years. He was serving a 5-year sentence, but was released early for good behavior.
What made you want to write this story?
So I had found out that he had been released from prison. That was one thing that I felt like the public would be interested in just because he was so well known. And, you know, this was kind of it was kind of shocking, really, when this happened. You know, he was very popular and, you know, very almost revered by teachers for helping lead the walkout. And then to see him very quickly, you know, his downfall. So I did want to write about that. But also, you know, there's been a lot in the news lately about schools being held accountable for predatory teachers. And this one had not, it had not been written about and the settlement had not been public. So I thought both of those reasons were important.
All right. Well, thanks, Jennifer. You can read Jennifer's coverage of this case and all her other education reporting. You'll find it on our website at oklahomawatch.org. While you're there, you can also sign up for her weekly newsletter, Education Watch. Reporter Paul Moneys is also a board member at Freedom of Information Oklahoma, which is among the groups celebrating Sunshine Week this week. Paul, tell us how Sunshine Week got started.
Yes, this has been around almost 2 decades now. It actually got its start in Florida, and it was originally called Sunshine Sunday. It was just one day back in 2002. That idea took hold pretty quickly in Florida, and it spread nationally. And the first Sunshine Week was actually in 2005. And it's generally done about mid-March every year to kind of celebrate March 16th, which is James Madison's birthday. Obviously, the father of the Constitution, the fourth president of the United States, also a big advocate of transparency and openness, and one of the authors of several of the Federalist Papers.
Now, Sunshine Week isn't just about journalism, right?
That's right. Yeah. Journalists obviously support it and are celebrating open records and transparency, but it's really about just government transparency for everybody, no matter what, the right to kind of see what your government does in your name, how it spends your tax dollars. And so it's really a broad array of civic groups and other groups like libraries and attorneys and anybody else that's just interested in any kind of open government and transparency.
A Freedom of Information Oklahoma recognized several people at its annual Sunshine Awards. Who won?
That's right. Yeah. This year, they give out awards annually to different people that they think should be celebrated for transparency efforts. They actually gave out five awards this year. The first one was to Attorney General Gentner Drummond for establishing an office of public counselor in his office to basically answer questions from the public, kind of cajole and poke agencies and other agencies to kind of give up public records. And then another person was Bruce Willingham, who is a publisher of the McCurtain County News. You might remember a while back, they had published a kind of secret meeting that was done in secret. They had a recording of that where there was some kind of stuff said about local reporters by people in power. And obviously that was kind of a big deal. And he didn't back down in terms of publishing that information. Also, there's an attorney that does a lot of FOI and open records things, Josh Lee. He was one of the instrumental attorneys in making sure that police dash cam footage is open for the public to view. And he also has established a website called FYBible.com, which is a great resource for people to look at. And then finally, the last person, but not least, is longtime journalist Bill Crum, also an FY Oklahoma board member, longtime reporter at the Oklahoman, used the Open Records Act in a lot of his reporting. And he's been retiring now, but has been celebrated for his career in transparency. And then finally, there was a special commendation this year. They gave it to the Oklahoma Supreme Court and Chief Justice John Kane IV. He agreed to basically put all past oral arguments of the court online. And so that's a good resource for people to look back and kind of see what's happened over the course of history in terms of the Supreme Court's oral arguments.
How FOI Oklahoma also every year has its own Razzie, if you will, right, called the Black Hole Award. Who was singled out this year for being the antithesis of government transparency?
That's right. Yeah, this is not an actual award. We don't actually have any kind of trophy to give. Obviously, if someone wants to come and pick it up or be awarded, none of our past recipients have ever shown up in person to accept that recognition. This year, that Black Hole Award went to State Superintendent Ryan Walters and his administration. He has obviously had thwarted a lot of the public's right to know in terms of just giving out information not only to journalists, but to lawmakers at the Capitol who are asking for basic information about spending. Also, he has gone on several kind of crusades against what he perceives to be as inappropriate books in school. His latest one, he's threatening accreditation in Edmond Public Schools for putting two kind of fairly celebrated novels in their curriculum and just available at their library. He's kind of said, look, that's not appropriate. And other school districts have joined Edmond in fighting back against that. And also, he's just his administration is kind of been very difficult to work with on a journalistic side. I can talk about that personally. Multiple open records requests, either just ignored or delayed. Even his chief communication officer just ignores any kind of press inquiry. So very well deserved award or recognition on the black hole front for Superintendent Ryan Walters.
Well, and not only with the Department of Ed, it hasn't only been open records and books, but subtle things like some open meetings issues where, you know, choosing to use a room that is too small to accommodate all the members of the public who wish to attend a public meeting and being disinclined to find a larger room to accommodate the crowd, more subtle things like that came into play as well, didn't they?
That's right. Yeah, there's been a lot of obviously interest because of the things that he said and the people that are coming out to these meetings that did not used to come out in past years. And so they've had some problems in terms of getting people there's the proper accommodation in that smaller meeting room that now for the demand of the people that want to see it. And of course, it's broadcast online too, but there's been some issues about who's signing up for public comment, who's jumping in the line, who's getting preferential treatment in terms of signing up and putting their thoughts in front of the board and superintendent for that stuff.
And I think it's worth reiterating that moment. It's not about access for board members or for journalists or even for legislators, right? It's about access for the public, for taxpayers, for voters, for any Oklahoma resident.
That's right. Yeah, it's for the communities of the public. It's not for any specific group that covers these meetings, that goes to these meetings. It's for the communities of the public. And so to kind of thwart those kind of openness and transparency places for people to speak out, to listen, to see what's going on, obviously a big deal and something that's obviously been in the minds of people who are going to those meetings.
Now, you've been covering Oklahoma government for nearly two decades. Has it gotten better or worse when it comes to gathering information from the government?
I will say overall, it's gotten worse just because of a delay standpoint. Now, it is kind of depending on the agency. There are some fantastic information officers at public agencies that know the law, know what's exempt, know what can be given out, and are very good and fast to work with. Now, that doesn't always hold true. Sometimes when it comes to political affiliated offices, they will bring on campaign people to be their spokespeople, and they have no background or in government or even government transparency and don't know how that works. And that's kind of obviously have to sometimes educate them and pull and push them along. But overall, I would say it's kind of been a pretty tougher way to get records and less understanding in people in power about how those records are actually used by the public and the media.
I think, Paul, in my experience as a reporter and an editor, and I'm also a board member at FOI, right? But my experience, I've found in Oklahoma that there are really, it seems to be almost two kinds of public information officers at state entities or government entities. There are those who seem to believe their job is to facilitate transparency, right? To help the public find the information they're looking for, to make sure they know when a meeting is going to be held and what's going to go on at that meeting, to get their hands on whatever record they're looking for, that they seem to think that's their job, is to help the public, right? And there's another group, it seems to me, that feels like their job is to somehow protect their agency from the public, right? To make it as difficult as possible and to give out as little information as possible. Is that similar to your experience?
That's right. Yeah, completely right. I mean, you kind of see a lot of this kind of protect the reputation of the agency or of the elected official or the director in charge. You know, a lot of that comes down to they just don't want to be embarrassed by decisions that they've made sometimes that people were questioning. And so it comes down to that. We're like, well, would you rather not talk about that because that's just inconvenient or we maybe messed up and don't want to admit it. But, you know, that's obviously part of government. We realize on the outside that government is made up of people. People make mistakes. You know, a big part of growing up is owning up those mistakes. But unfortunately, you don't see that attitude a lot in government officials that are thwarting information like this.
Now, there are some lawmakers at the Capitol who seem to recognize that the transparency laws in Oklahoma might need an update, right?
That's right. Yeah, there's been several bills filed this session and, of course, in past sessions in the past to update our open records to kind of reflect maybe modern times. In fact, I can kind of pinpoint a couple of cases in terms of just the simple act of emailing a record. You know, the act does not actually allow for that specifically. Now, most agencies will kind of just do that anyway, but you can have some agencies that will dig in and say, well, look, the act doesn't require us to email this at all. Come down to our office and get it, which obviously kind of thwarts the information and the free flow of kind of information on these operations of these government agencies. So there's stuff like that that's really simple fixes, you know, from time to time.
Of course, the flip side of that one is nothing in the act says they can't email it.
That's right. Yeah, it's up to them. It's their discretion. But they have said that, look, you know, there's a couple of sheriffs that have said, look, you have to come down and get this information in person.
Yeah, come on out here to Cimarron County and pick it up in person.
Right. And so there's little fixes like that that I think a lot of lawmakers understand. And then there's obviously a lot of bills every year in terms of should there be a time limit or not. I mean, we right now have a kind of standard of prompt and reasonable, which really is in the eye of either the requester or the agency that's holding the records. And so it's really kind of a murky area, but also, you know, journalists are concerned that if you do put a time limit on things, then that will be the new floor for
everybody's going to run the clock.
That's right. Yeah. And so there's issues that go back and forth like that. And I would say overall, I think that the lawmakers are obviously in favor of transparency, but we do see kind of a one step forward, two step back sometimes. And a lot of stuff, there's holes that get put in and exemptions put in that we kind of don't expect or kind of see that came up at the last minute.
Well, talking about the language that exists in the Open Record Act and Open Meeting Act, which were put in place back in the 80s, you mentioned that it doesn't address email at all, but there is a section in the Open Record Act that addresses faxing records to people. It's hard to remember the last time that was used. And of course, there have been so many other technological changes. Certainly during the pandemic, we saw a big upheaval in public meetings where, people couldn't go in person, not even the members of the board could go in person. And so that raised a lot of questions about the legality of a meeting by video conference. And there were a couple of emergency things that were put in place during the pandemic and then removed or altered afterward. But certainly email is not the only bit of technology that has affected meetings and records retention and accessibility.
That's right. Yeah, I think the pandemic really kind of shows both the power of video meetings. Everyone kind of got a chance to see their government at work in different ways. And of course, there's kind of a double-edged sword to that, too, is that, you know, if you go strictly only to video meetings, which is what some agencies and boards and commissions want to do, then you kind of don't really see anything in person happening behind the scenes. You don't see anyone checking in, you know, sitting behind someone in the background that you can't even see on camera, offering advice during a meeting. You might not see
holding up cue cards from the back of the room.
I mean, stuff like that, or telling them how to vote during things. You know, there's stuff like that you would see in a live public meeting in person that you may not see on video. And of course, there's issues in terms of executive session. How do you do that? How do you let people know, okay, this board has gone into executive session, which obviously the public cannot see. But then when do they come back? Do you have to notice every hour that they're still in there? Tell people by text and there's notification issues on that. That's kind of a little complicated that right now they're trying to work that out. And there's a lot of back and forth between lawmakers, the Oklahoma Press Association and other interested groups in terms of, you know, making that work for everybody, but still having transparency as the paramount part.
Where can listeners go to find out more about Sunshine Week and transparency?
So definitely check out foioklahoma.org website. There's a lot of information on there and materials. And then from a national side of things, there's sunshineweek.org, all one word. Plenty of materials there, plenty of articles to check out, and also strategies and help if you are a member of the public looking for records from your government. So there's a lot of fantastic resources out there. And of course, anytime anyone has any questions, they can reach out to FI Oklahoma board members. I'm one, you're one. We're happy to answer questions. We do this for a living sometimes, and it's a lot easier for us to kind of figure some of this stuff out than the folks that don't do it all the time.
Well, thanks, Paul. You can read all of Paul's coverage about state government, which frequently involves transparency questions, along with all of Paul's other work. You'll find it all at our website, oklahomawatch.org. You've been listening to Long Story Short, a weekly podcast that helps you get deeper into the investigative stories reported by Oklahoma Watch, which you can find on the web at oklahomawatch.org. This episode was recorded at the AT&T Podcast Studio. For Oklahoma Watch, I'm Ted Strooley. Thanks for listening.